Welcome to Clinical IQ Drug Class Explainers. I'm Sarah Mitchell and with me is Dr. Anzal Kurbain, pharmaceutical physician. Today we're looking at JAK inhibitors, a class of drugs that started in rheumatoid arthritis and has now spread across dermatology, gastroenterology and beyond. They're also drugs that come with a safety debate that's still very much live. Anzal, let's start from scratch. What is a JAK?
JAK stands for Janus kinase, a family of intracellular enzymes that act as signal relay stations inside immune cells. When cytokines, the chemical messengers that drive inflammation, bind to their receptors on the outside of a cell, JAK enzymes on the inside of the cell phosphorylate proteins called STATs, which then travel to the nucleus and switch on inflammatory genes. JAK inhibitors block that signaling pathway. No JAK activation means no STAT signaling. And the inflammatory cascade is interrupted upstream of gene transcription. It's a quite different mechanism from biologics like TNF inhibitors, which work outside the cell. JAK inhibitors work inside.
So they're like a relay in the inflammatory signaling chain?
So the four JAK enzymes are JAK1, JAK2, JAK3 and TYK2. Different cytokine receptors use different combinations of them. JAK1 and JAK3 are used by cytokines like IL-4, IL-6 and IL-7. Central to the inflammatory response in rheumatoid arthritis and atopic dermatitis. JAK2 is essential for hematopoiesis. It's used by erythropoietin and thrombopoietin, which is why JAK2 inhibition can affect red cell and platelet counts. TYK2 is involved in IL-12, and IL-23 signaling, relevant in psoriasis. The drugs differ in how selectively they target these enzymes, and that selectivity partly explains their different side effect profiles.
And that's what JAK inhibitors do, block those enzymes.
The first generation, tofacitinib and baricitinib, are relatively non-selective. Tofacitinib is primarily JAK1 and JAK3. Baricitinib inhibits JAK1 and JAK2. The second generation, upadacitinib and filgotinib, are preferentially JAK1 selective, which in theory spares JAK2 and reduces hematological effects. Upadacitinib, in particular, has shown very high efficacy across multiple indications, rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, atopic dermatitis, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis. It's become one of the broadest indication JAK inhibitors we have.
Which drugs are we talking about? There seem to be quite a few in this class now.
Yes. Infections are the most clinically important class effect. Herpes zoster shingles is notably increased, and this is thought to be because JAK-STAT signaling is important for T-cell mediated immunity against varicella zoster virus. The recommendation across the class is to check varicella zoster immune status before starting and to vaccinate non-immune patients. Live vaccines should be avoided while on JAK inhibitors. Upper respiratory tract infections and urinary tract infections are also more common. The immune suppression is real and it's additive if you're combining with methotrexate or corticosteroids.
Can you briefly map which drug goes with which condition?
The oral surveillance study is the one that changed prescribing practice. It was a post-marketing safety study mandated by the FDA comparing tofacitinib to TNF inhibitors in older patients with rheumatoid arthritis who had cardiovascular risk factors. It found higher rates of major cardiovascular events, venous thromboembolism, and malignancy in the tofacitinib arm. That led to regulatory action, new warnings, and a restriction in many countries that JAK inhibitors should be used with caution or avoided in patients over 65, smokers, patients with cardiovascular risk, or those with malignancy history. It didn't kill the class, but it narrowed the appropriate patient population.
That's a remarkable range of conditions for one drug class. What's the advantage over biologics, which we'll cover in the next episode?
The big one is that they're oral. Biologics, like the TNF inhibitors, are injections or infusions. JAK inhibitors are tablets taken once or twice a day at home. For patients who are needle phobic or who struggle with injections, that's a significant quality of life improvement. They also have rapid onset. You can often see meaningful clinical benefit within 2 to 4 weeks, which is faster than many conventional DMARDs like methotrexate.
That speed of onset sounds clinically useful. What about efficacy overall?
NICE in the UK currently requires patients to have failed at least 2 conventional DMARDs and typically 1 biologic before a JAK inhibitor can be prescribed in rheumatoid arthritis. There's active debate about whether that positioning is still appropriate given the efficacy data. In atopic dermatitis, upatacitinib and baricitinib are licensed for moderate to severe disease after inadequate response to topical therapy. And abrocitinib, another JAK1 inhibitor, is also licensed in that space. The positioning is evolving as the evidence base grows.
Let's talk about the safety concerns, because I know there's been significant regulatory attention on this class.
The main practical things are: check bloods before starting, full blood count, because JAK inhibitors can cause anemia, neutropenia, and thrombocytopenia, and lipid profile, because LDL cholesterol can rise. Then repeat bloods at 4 to 8 weeks after initiation and after dose changes. Check for latent TB and hepatitis B and C before starting. Same with biologics. Renal and hepatic impairment affect drug levels. Dose reductions are needed in moderate to severe renal impairment for most agents, and oral bioavailability is actually a practical advantage. These are tablets, not injections, which some patients strongly prefer.
That sounds serious. What happened as a result?
Oral administration is genuinely meaningful for patients. Injecting yourself weekly or fortnightly is manageable for most people, but it is a barrier for some, particularly older patients with dexterity issues, those with needle phobia, or patients who travel frequently and have difficulty keeping biologics refrigerated. JAK inhibitors are tablets once or twice daily, no cold chain, no injection sites. For a patient who needs long-term immunosuppression, that quality of life difference is real and worth discussing.
So these drugs haven't been pulled from the market, but there are stricter rules on who gets them.
Know the oral surveillance findings. Apply them to patient selection. Vaccinate against zoster before starting. Monitor bloods. And have an honest conversation with patients about the benefit-risk balance, particularly in those who are older, have cardiovascular risk, or have had malignancy. These are highly effective drugs used appropriately in the right patient. The evidence is there. The key is patient selection and ongoing monitoring, not avoidance.
What about the infection risks? You mentioned serious infections.
Yes, serious infections are a genuine concern with any immunosuppressant, and JAK inhibitors are no exception. The most clinically important ones to know about are reactivation of latent tuberculosis, so you must screen for latent TB before starting, exactly as you would with a biologic, and reactivation of herpes zoster, which is shingles. The risk of shingles with JAK inhibitors is meaningfully higher than with biologics. That's why the shingles vaccine, Shingrix, the inactivated one, should be offered before starting if possible.
And you can't use the live vaccine once they're on treatment.
Correct. Shingrix is non-live, so it's fine in immunosuppressed patients. The old live attenuated zoster vaccine, Zostervax, should not be given on treatment. Another thing to check is varicella immunity. If a patient has never had chickenpox and isn't immune, they're at risk of primary varicella infection, which can be severe in immunosuppressed adults.
What about VTE, the blood clot risk?
This was identified particularly with tofacitinib at higher doses, and there's a plausible mechanism involving JAK2 inhibition and its effects on platelet function and the coagulation system. Current guidance recommends avoiding JAK inhibitors in patients at high VTL risk, for example, those with a prior history of DVT or pulmonary embolism or significant immobility.
What monitoring does a patient on a JAK inhibitor need?
Before starting, a full blood count, liver function tests, renal function, lipid profile, TB screening with an IGRA test, that's a blood test for latent TB, and a check of hepatitis B and C status. Once on treatment, LFTs and FBC at 4 to 8 weeks initially, then every 3 months, and lipids at 12 weeks. JAK inhibitors can raise LDL cholesterol, which is worth managing. Blood pressure monitoring is also worthwhile.
Where do JAK inhibitors sit in the treatment pathway? When does a patient get to one?
In rheumatoid arthritis, current NICE guidance positions them after failure of at least 2 conventional DMARDs, usually including methotrexate, and generally after failure of or contraindication to a biologic. So for most patients, it's a third or fourth line option in RA. In atopic dermatitis, abrocitinib and upadacitinib come in after topicals, and dupilumab have failed or aren't suitable. The NICE technology appraisals are worth checking because they're updated regularly and the positioning does shift.
Is there a JAK inhibitor you choose over others for any particular reason?
It depends heavily on the indication. For atopic dermatitis, the head-to-head data for upadacitinib is particularly strong. For RA with cardiovascular risk factors, you might lean towards filgotinib, which is a more selective JAK1 inhibitor and didn't show the same MACE signal, though the regulatory caution has been applied class-wide. For alopecia areata, baricitinib is the licensed option. It's very indication-specific.
Any clinical pearls before we wrap up?
The one I always come back to is screen before you start. TB, varicella, hepatitis B. These are the infections that can be catastrophic if you trigger a reactivation in an immunosuppressed patient. Get the shingles vaccine in if you can, and make sure patients understand they should tell any doctor they see, including Ande, that they're on an immunosuppressant, because the signs of serious infection can be blunted.
Let me summarise. JAK inhibitors block the JAK-STAT signalling pathway, knocking out a broad range of inflammatory cytokines in one go. They're oral, work quickly, and cover a remarkable range of conditions from RA to eczema to alopecia. The safety profile, particularly after oral surveillance, means they come with boxed warnings for MACE, malignancy, VTE and serious infections. Patient selection is critical. Use caution in those over 65, smokers or with cardiovascular risk. Screen for TB and check varicella immunity before starting. Is there anything I've missed?
That's comprehensive. The only thing I'd add is that for the right patient, these drugs can be genuinely life-changing. Patients with severe eczema who've been told nothing can be done, some of them have had near complete clearance on JAK inhibitors. The art is matching the drug to the right patient with a proper informed consent conversation.
Brilliantly put. Thank you, Anzal. That's our episode on JAK inhibitors. Next time on Clinical IQ Drug Class Explainers, we're tackling TNF inhibitors, the original biologic class that changed inflammatory disease treatment and which now has a whole ecosystem of biosimilars saving the NHS significant amounts of money. I'm Sarah Mitchell. Join us next time.